Today's Taisho will be on Case 25 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, Kyozan's Dream. In a dream, Kyozan Osho went to Maitreya's palace and was led to sit in the third seat. A senior monk struck with a gavel and said, "Today, the one in the third seat will speak." Kyozan rose and, striking with the gavel, said, "The truth of the Mahayana is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations. Hear the truth, hear the truth." Mumon's comment. Now tell me, did Kyozan preach or did he not? If he opens his mouth, he is lost. If he seals his mouth, he is lost. Even if he neither opens nor shuts his mouth, he is 108,000 miles from the truth. Mumon's verse. In broad daylight, under the blue sky, he forges a dream in a dream and makes up a monstrous story and tries to deceive the whole crowd. Thank everybody for coming here to practice this morning, this beautiful spring morning. This koan, it has a very dreamlike quality. Several weeks ago we looked at another koan that had a very dreamlike quality. In fact, this one actually says it starts in a dream. Kyozan Osho. Osho is like priest, means priest. Priest Kyozan, in a dream, went to Maitreya's palace. So this is like a dream world. Maitreya is thought to be the next Buddha. So Siddhartha Gautama is called in Mahayana tradition Shakyamuni, the sage of the Shakya people. But after Shakyamuni, there's going to be another Buddha to come whose name is Maitreya. And Maitreya has a palace here in this dream. In a dream, Kyozan Osho went to Maitreya's palace and was led to sit in the third seat. So there's some kind of a seating arrangement in the palace. And a senior monk struck with a gavel. There's a board, and he struck the board with a gavel and announced, "Today, the one in the third seat will speak." So this is sort of like a dream. Kyozan rose and, striking with the gavel, hitting the board with the gavel, said, "The truth of the Mahayana is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations. Hear the truth. Hear the truth." Now, I'm sure you have dreams like this yourself, or not quite like this. You probably don't go to Maitreya's palace. But you might have dreams where you have to, and I have these dreams even now. You know, I've mentioned this before, but I have a recurring dream. Among others, one of my recurring dreams is that I'm going to have to take a test, an exam, and I have to go take the test, and then I suddenly realize, my God, I haven't studied a word of it. You know, sometimes it's a history course. I don't know why. But I have to take a history test, and I suddenly realize I haven't gone to the class once, and I haven't read a single word, and I'm not going to be allowed to graduate without that class. And then I sort of, part of my mind says, well, wait a minute, you already have your PhD, this is a dream, but But I'll have great anxiety about this. This causes me great anxiety. And I have other dreams, too, that are similar to this. I have a dream where, this is a recurring dream, and it would be interesting to see what a psychiatrist would say about this one. But in the dream, I go up into the attic of my house, and I realize that the roof is leaking badly. In fact, you can see the sky. You can see the sky, the cloudy sky, through some of the holes in the roof, and water's coming in, and it's pouring down through the building. And sometimes in my dream, I realize that the whole attic area is just too huge. Sometimes in my dream, it becomes a huge area, like a warehouse almost. And I realize it's just too big to patch up. I think this has something to do with home ownership, you know. Every time I turn around, I seem to have a $1,000 bill to fix something in my house. So maybe that's it, you know. Who knows? But you have these dreams, I'm sure. Maybe you're being pursued and you have to run and you're trying to run away and your feet get heavier and heavier. I don't know if you've ever had that one. And sometimes you might be pursued and maybe you can fly like a bird. When I was a kid, I used to have those dreams. So we all have these dreams, and we all learn at some point to distinguish between dream and reality, right? Sometimes as kids, it's hard to distinguish between dream and reality. I actually had a hard time distinguishing sometime between dream and reality when I was a little kid. It seemed like I actually had this dream once where I had my parents didn't want to let my brother and me watch spooky movies, but we liked to watch, you know, Frankenstein and those kinds of movies, and we'd get terrified, right? You know, especially when you had to go to bed. If you watched a movie like that, you know, you had to go upstairs and it was dark and frightening. And you could just lie in bed and the terror were just waves of terror, right? You know, what could be under the bed? You know, maybe Frankenstein or something like that. And I remember my father tucked me into bed once, and I was looking at his arm, and I was following his from his wrist up to his elbow, and then it turned into a bone, like a skeleton. And I was, and the next thing I knew, I woke up and it was morning. But I was so sure that my father's arm had turned into a skeleton, you know. And then when I saw him, you know, shaving with his cigarette hanging out of his mouth and everything, I knew everything was okay again, that it was really Dad and not a skeleton and so on. We learn gradually to separate dream from reality. And this is an important part of becoming an adult, right? You know, this is part of becoming like a normal human being. And we gradually realize that there's this realm of dream, which is unreal, and then there's this world we call reality, which is real. So, in your dream, one minute you can be in the kitchen, and next minute you can be in California. But in reality, you would have to take a plane to do that, or something like that. So we learn, you know, there's this distinction. As we grow up, we put more and more trust in reality, in the waking, ordinary consciousness we call reality. And this is a good thing, because in certain ways, our dreams seem to be a realm of craziness, right? You know, the realm of ghosts and skeletons, or running and your feet get heavy and so on and so on. So, you know, there's dream, there's reality, and as you grow up, you learn how to make this distinction. And we put a lot of faith in reality, you know, this conscious waking life. Yeah. And you know, as we've gone on in our history as human beings, you know, we've put more and more faith in waking reality. If you look back on the things people used to believe, it might look to you as though dreams were intermingled with reality in ancient times, you know. So, for example, there's all kinds of myths about people who go to like a watery place, and there's creatures in the water who lure them to their deaths. You know, this is actually quite a common myth. You know, there's all kinds of dreams like this, that people are afraid of things at night, you know, there's spirits that roam the earth at night. I should have saved this one for Halloween, I think. Spirits roam the earth at night, you know. So people are afraid of the dark, you know, afraid to go out at night. I can remember at one time when we were little, we used to walk by a cemetery on the military base where I lived, and you know, my brother and I would run by the cemetery, you know, run by the cemetery, scared, you know, you didn't know what was going to happen. And, you know, people, human beings used to have a lot of beliefs like that, you know, crazy beliefs, you know. In the history of human beings, in the 18th century, late 17th and early 18th century, we had like this revolution. It started in Europe. And it's called the Enlightenment. It wasn't like Buddhist enlightenment, it was Western enlightenment. And the idea was that we want to put a lot of emphasis on waking consciousness, see? That, you know, our reality is too intermingled with dreams, and we want to put a lot of emphasis on waking consciousness. And we want to be really awake. You know, it's called enlightenment. You know, we want to be really awake. And that means, you know, not only are we going to, you know, not to have any dreamy nonsense in our waking reality, we're going to test things out. You know, we develop science, right? So, you know, if somebody says, if you put a bunch of rags in a jar, they're going to turn into mice, because, you know, whenever you find rags in your house, there's mice inside. You say, oh, we'll test it, you know, test it out. We'll take some rags, we'll put it in a controlled area, and we'll see if any mice appear. And they don't, as a matter of fact. So we know, you know, actually rags don't spontaneously turn into mice, you know, things like that. That's like dream thinking, right? Dream thinking is that if you put some rags somewhere, they'll turn into mice. So we don't want to go into dream thinking. That's a bad, see. So we're going to be fully awake all the time. And so you get to the Enlightenment, you know, where people put a lot of emphasis on logic and rationality, and being fully in the waking mood, waking consciousness, and also a science. Science is like the most awake thing, right? Because, you know, I can have a dream, and it's my dream, and I may or may not be able to explain it to you because it might be so crazy, right? But science is based on something that can always be explained totally, right? So it's like no matter who does this, no matter who puts this chemical in the tube and then this chemical, this reaction is it's going to turn blue no matter what, right? You know? So science is like super waking consciousness. And that's sort of how we think. And it seems like a good thing, you know? So we've gotten more and more sort of like into waking consciousness and more rational, logical, these are like super awake states, logic, rationality, empirical, and so on. And this all makes a lot of sense. It's all pretty good, right? And things have gotten better. When you get sick now, you know, people don't take bones and rattle the bones or gourds, you know, and do dances with snakes and things like that. You know, they test your blood and they find there's this stuff in your blood, and there's research on how to, you know, maybe some antibiotic you take, and then, you know, 3 days later, you're healthy again. It's really wonderful. I'm not criticizing this at all. So this is really great, right? Not to being in this dreamy mind, but being in waking consciousness. And the whole modern world is based on this idea, you know, being awake, fully awake, totally logical, rational, empirical, and so on and so on. And it's really good, and it is. But, when people began to study the mind, they also began to look at it in these terms. You know, people began to study things like the circulation of the blood in the body. They began to study the motion of objects as they go through the air. This was all could be studied empirically and rationally and with waking consciousness, and we could learn a lot. And at some point, people began to study the mind itself. They said, well, what about the mind itself? And somebody I very much admire was Sigmund Freud, you know, because Freud came along and said, you know, the mind too is not like a box full of ghosts. It actually has its own processes which can be studied scientifically. And Freud basically came up with this idea that we have a conscious mind. He was really like a genius. I think Freud was one of the greatest thinkers in world history, even though he's not that popular right now in psychology departments. I really think he was a stupendously intelligent person and right about many things. And Freud said, look, you know, we have different kinds of awareness, different kinds of consciousness, or different kinds of awareness, and one of them is consciousness, right? That's when we're awake, you know, reality is consistently the same, it's shareable, you and I will agree, you know, what's in front of us is not a ghost, it's a moonlight on the ground, and so on, you know, so Freud said there's this thing called consciousness, you know, the conscious mind. And it should be rational and so on. But he also knew, you know, people had these crazy dreams, you know, these crazy dreams. And also, they had these crazy dream-like inner lives, you know. So, you know, we have our waking consciousness, but then, you know, there are these things that bother us that are not necessarily very rational. So, you know, we might be afraid of something. I have a friend of mine. He's a very distinguished scholar. And he's published two books now, and he had a meteoric rise as a professor. So he's 10 years younger than I am, and he's really published so much that he's farther along than I am. He's just like a very bright young man. And he was telling me, we're good friends, and we have a good relationship. And he was telling me that he can't drive over bridges. This is really true. It's okay, like a little bridge, like over the John Lynch Bridge over the Raritan. But he and his family go to Chincoteague every summer, and there's a big bridge down there in Maryland. I can't remember what it's called, but it goes on and it goes up. It's a little bit like the bridge by Perth Amboy, only much bigger, right? If you take the parkway and you go by Perth Amboy, there's that bridge. I can't remember what that one's called, but it's big. Well, this one in Maryland is even bigger. It's even higher. And my friend said, you know, I can't drive on that. I'm overcome with anxiety, and I'm paralyzed. I just can't So what happens is when he goes down there, they stop at like a rest, rest stations or one of these places where you can get something to eat by the road, and he and his wife exchange roles, and she drives over the bridge, and they do it quietly so the kids don't notice. Now, you know, in every other way, this guy is totally, we'd say, totally rational. But it's like at that moment, he's overcome with these sort of irrational anxieties. And Freud noticed this all the time. He was working with the people in Vienna, and he noticed that people had these crazy dream-like impulses. And so, you know, Freud says basically, you know, what we should be doing is trying to limit the power of the unconscious mind more and more, and basically bring more and more, live more and more in a conscious way. See, conscious way. So this was sort of what psychiatry is all about, is living consciously and freeing ourselves from like all the ghosts that are in the unconscious. This is like a very modern way of seeing things, and very very much part of what's been going on for like 300 years in the world. And you know, my friend probably will go someday to a counselor or a psychiatrist and try to uncover the cause of his phobia, as they said, phobia, going over that bridge. But, you know, one of the strange things about this whole way of thinking is that if you look at world history, since for the last 300 years, it's kind of weird in a certain way, because things don't necessarily go as you might expect. So if you look at the 20th century, you know, the 20th century has been the most rational century of all times, right? We have universities, so far, it was the most rational century of all times. Universities, you know, public education. We have, millions of people take philosophy courses. You know, millions of people are scientists. Okay. So, you know, you would think this is like the golden age of reason, right? Right? But in fact, you know, I think my figures may be a little inflated, but I think something like 15 million people were killed in World War I. And I think something like 25 million people, in fact, that's probably too low, because I think something like 15 million people were killed just in Russia alone. So if you count Holocaust victims, all the fatalities in Russia, and so on, you know, World War II, I don't know, 30 million? And then Stalin is supposed to have killed 15-20 million. In China, something like that number died. So, you know, the odd thing is that if you actually tallied up all the centuries in terms of like sheer death, you know, the 20th century would actually be like number one. So, and it didn't work out to be even worse, because, you know, we used the nuclear weapons just a couple times, but we almost had a nuclear war that would have topped that, it would have, you know, kicked it up to like 100 million people. And I'm not the only person to point this out. There, a lot of people in the 20th century have noticed that, you know, even though it's getting more and more rational, you know, in a certain way, our world is not really getting necessarily, it's more a split, right? It's like reason and yet crazy, right? It's like we're reasonable about how we go about things, but what we do is somewhat crazy, yeah? And this is, I think, not an insignificant fact, and I don't think I'm just playing with ideas or playing with words. There's something truly nuts about the 20th century. I mean, when you look at somebody like Hitler, it's plain, right? And Hitler came out of the most educated and advanced society the world had ever seen. Germans were much better educated than Americans before World War II. Much better, and it was an industrial powerhouse, and most people thought of Germany as the most advanced society. So this is a very strange picture, right? So maybe we've got it wrong. You know, I'd like to just suggest that maybe we've misunderstood things, you know, in some important ways, you know, because just maybe what we call consciousness is actually not real. The world we call conscious waking mind is not real. And it's not it's not what we thought it was. It's not the benign, dependable place we thought it was, you know, or we've been thinking it was. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but one of the members of our group came in to see me the other day in my office, and he's doing a lot of stuff on the brain and psychology. And he gave me something to read that basically made the case that, you know, what we see with our eye is not just what's there. You know, when I was growing up, when we used to study vision, it used to show an eyeball, and it would show the eyeball, and it would show the image in the biology textbook. You saw the eyeball, and it would show the light. It would show like a little girl with a dog, right? There'd be a little girl with a dog, and then there'd be the rays of light going in through the iris, right? And then the image would flip upside down and be projected on the retina, and it would be an upside down picture of a little girl with her dog. And then you could see the nerves going to the brain. So the message of the picture was, you know, I see the little girl with the dog, the beam of light, the light beams go into my eye, the lens flips it upside down, hits the retina, and then those signals go to my brain, and that's what I see. So my brain is like is just recording what my eye is actually seeing. But now that people have been able to do more sophisticated studies of the brain, they know, they've said, according to this study anyway, that what we see with our minds when we see, the mental images we form, are only something like 20% determined by those light rays, by those inputs from the visual stimuli, okay? Other information shapes our visual experience, and basically the brain is processing the image. It's taking that 20% of input, and the rest of the information that shapes the mental image isn't coming from from those rays of light. It's coming from other parts of the brain, from other inputs and other neural processing. So, you know, the interesting thing is that what we see may not really be what's there. It may be something we are shaping texturing and clipping and expanding and contracting and so on. So the world we call reality may not really be quite real. It may be very much something that our brains create, and also it may be something that culture creates very much. You know, culture trains us to see things in a certain way, and it reaches down into our experience, and it prevents us from noticing certain things, and it encourages us to notice other things. I just think this is inescapable. And I could give you many examples. You know, I lived part of my life in the South, in the American South, in Virginia. I have to say that I met many nice people in the South, but Southern culture was at that time very unhappy place to be. You know, I grew up on a military base that was outside of a town called Williamsburg, Virginia. And it was a totally segregated society, even though segregation was, in fact, illegal at that time. When I went to school, I never, even though my school had many black students in it, I never took a class with a black student, and I never even realized this till years later. But the school board was very clever in keeping all the white kids separate from all the black kids, so that we never actually were in contact. We never saw them in the cafeteria. Somebody worked very hard to preserve racial distinctions. And I remember going to a public pool I remember it was a public pool, and during this was like during the civil rights era, and some black people in town wanted to use the pool, and one of my friends, a guy named Sonny, was a very racist person. His father was quite a vehement racist. They were a local family in the area, and I had met this kid in school, and we were friends, you know. But, you know, my friend, this is rather amazing, but my friend was very upset about getting into physical contact at the pool with black people. And he was actually convinced that he could feel somebody's blackness. Now that's crazy, right? But that's culture. And I'm not making it up. This was a common, you know, in the South, black people use this water fountain. White people use this one. You didn't want contamination, right? You have this all over the world. This is culture. And you know, people can claim I can feel the contamination. I've just got to go home and wash my hands right now. You know, now that's crazy, but that's the power of culture to induce experience, right? You know, culture is capable of making you want to throw up sometime, right? It's capable of making you shake and tremble. It's capable of making you see or not see, and it can control what you see. So, you know, actually, what we call reality is not like neutral and innocent. It's not necessarily a real, like empirically real in the way we think. The brain is shaping it. Culture's shaping it, you know, all the time, and often in very negative ways, you know, in my opinion, very destructive ways. And maybe this is what's wrong with the 20th century. You know, we put so much faith on in waking consciousness, and there's so much violence. And people were using science, for example, to do all kinds of terrible things. There was a scientist in Germany, Dr. Rascher was his name, who did all these studies on human, it's rather grim to talk about, but really horrible as a matter of fact. Rascher was a well-trained physiologist, and he, during the Nazi period, he took Jews and he would put them in like ice water and measure their skin, their galvanic skin responses, their body temperature, and so on. He kept meticulous scientific notes, right? I mean, he was a scientist. The fact that he was destroying human beings, it just doesn't even enter into the picture, right? I'm sure he thought of himself as a rational man, you know. So I guess I've made the point. You know, that what we call waking consciousness, empirical consciousness and so on, is not really like really real necessarily on many different levels. And maybe in the 20th century, we've got it wrong. You know, we've got it wrong. Because we say, you know, this is the reality and the unconscious is the dream. But you know, it may be just the opposite. See, the interesting thing is that, you know, as people do more and more research on the brain, they realize that the unconscious mind actually takes in a lot more information than consciousness does. You know, and the unconscious mind often knows more than the conscious mind does. Isn't that interesting? I mean, the unconscious may be more alert and may be more awake and in contact with reality than the conscious mind. See, I mean, that's straight Zen, right? That's what we believe in Zen. And there's a lot of evidence to support this. You know, I was reading this book the other day on violence in the world. And it was by a military historian, and he said something so interesting. He said that there's a lot of evidence that in the Civil War and World War I and so on, in a lot of wars, there's a lot of evidence that people, soldiers in the trenches, didn't actually fight. This is fascinating. But historians have actually looked at things like how many guns were never fired at some of the major Civil War battles. And it has always been like a puzzle for historians, because they look at the number of, after the battle, they clean up all the bodies and they pick up all the weapons. And apparently people actually kept records during the Civil War of how many of the condition of like rifles. This is really true. This military historian, I wish I could remember his name right now, but I can give it to you if you'd like. He said that historians were baffled by the fact that large numbers of these weapons were never fired. And it was assumed at the time that people had dropped their weapons in panic. But it might not be that way. This historian said what actually happens is a lot of people refuse to kill. Isn't that interesting? That the natural impulse is not to kill. And that you have to drill it into people's heads. Those are the Yankees. Those are the Rebs, you know. And you have to build that resentment. You have to build that collective consciousness and make them kill. And he said a lot of people just wouldn't do it. You know, that you drafted them, you put them in uniforms, you handed them a gun, they went out there onto the battlefield, and they wouldn't fire their weapons. And when they had the chance, they threw the weapon down and ran away. Now that gives me real hope. That's wonderful. And he says there's a lot of evidence this one has gone on for more than a century. There's a lot of evidence, even in ancient times, he goes into like medieval battles and stuff, that a lot of people just didn't want to be there, they didn't want to kill, and they refused to participate quietly. I mean, remember that you know, you can be shot for refusing to fight. In World War I, a French division mutinied. In World War I, they marched into Paris and said, "We're not fighting anymore. This is crazy." And the leaders were hanged, and a lot of people were, like, every fifth person or something was shot. So they had to go back and fight. So anyway, the point is that it might be culture. It might be like you have to train people to hate and to kill. And basically, impulse is not to do those things. You know, that's a different way of thinking about things. But it might be true. There's, you know, even with things like, you know, if you look at things like look at consumerism. You know, again, we sort of assume that people have a natural desire to own so many clothes they can't put them in their closet, right? You know, people have a natural desire to own so much stuff they can't even keep track of it, and to be deeply in debt. It's like a natural desire, right? So we might say, well, people are basically consumers, and we need to give them rationality and say, don't be such a consumer. You have to be critical, you know, and use your reasoning powers, and don't give way to your unconscious impulses to buy all these clothes, right? But you know, if that were true, right, we wouldn't have to spend a dime on advertising, right? Because people would just naturally want to run to the store and buy all this stuff. But you know, actually businesses spend billions and billions of dollars on advertising, hammering home in the crude conditioning, right? You must get this, you must get this. And actually, I think they have to spend so much money because people don't particularly need this or want this stuff. You have to constantly drill it into their heads, you know. It's like you have to train people to fight and hate. Because it's not the natural condition of humans to fight and hate. I'm not saying people don't get mad, but it might not be the natural condition of human beings to want to line somebody up in their sights whom they never have ever met and mow down in across a field, right? It might not be your natural impulse, really, to go to Kmart or go to Walmart or go wherever and buy everything you can get your hands on, you know? That might not be the case. Maybe we have to condition people. So what I'm saying is that even though culture and the world of waking consciousness seems so mighty and so real, you know, you go into New York and you look at those buildings, and that's what waking consciousness has created, those mighty buildings, and we feel so powerless and small. And it seems so clear that this consciousness is the unbeatable giant, right? You know, when you look at the fruits of consciousness, it's like madness in a way, because we have the technology to build those beautiful buildings, but you know, we're going to heat up the environment to a point where life might be impossible. We could have a greenhouse effect that would eventually make this like Mars or something, you know, very incredibly hot planet. And so it's like we have rationality in our technical culture, but what we do is really crazy in a way. And it may be the case that it's not, our craziness isn't natural. It's highly artificial, you know. I hope I'm not sounding crazy myself today, you know, but it may be the case that the unconscious mind is our great ally, and not a realm of ghosts and monsters. You know, that the unconscious mind is maybe this wonderful helper that we can turn to in trying to deal with all the craziness of our world. And the unconscious mind in Zen, you know, is thought to be a bigger mind, more in contact with reality than the little mind, the conscious mind. It's this unconscious mind, which we call in Zen Mu Xin, is when we're in Mu Xin, we may be processing more information than we are when we're sitting calculating with a piece of paper in front of us, or thinking philosophical thoughts. You know, it's a deeper kind of experience, like whole body, whole being experience. Involves your heart and your emotions much more directly. And I got an email from Jaru. Some of you know Jaru. And she was just writing to me about something that had happened to her, but it was so perceptive. And it's happened to me too, this kind of thing. But she had done meditation in the evening, and then she went to sleep. She had like a nap, and she woke up, and she said there was this roaring sound in the room, this roaring. And she woke out of sleep thinking, my God, what is it? Is the building falling apart? And it was just this astonishing roaring sound that sounded like it was going to rip the place apart. She woke up, and for a while she didn't know what was going on, but then she looked over and she saw it was just the heater in the room. There was a forced air heater in the room where she was sleeping. And of course, as soon as she said, oh, it's just a forced air heater, the sound recedes and it becomes just this minor background noise. Now this is like, I think, the flexibility of reality, right? Because, you know, when we're in deep Mu Xin, suddenly sounds we might have put in a corner of our minds or our attention can be very powerful, very, very present. And you know, who is to say which is the reality or not, you know? In other words, you know, I think Jaru, when she just woke up, was having like an immediate experience of the moment without the mediation of culture, without the mediation of so-called reason. And a very different experience. You know, and it might be the whole world, all of our reality is experienced in this, is contained and limited in this way. You know, what Jaru may have been experiencing is what we call in Zen first Nen experience, the pure experience without interpretation. And then, you know, as she woke up and said, oh, it's just the heater, you put it into second Nen and third Nen categories. Yeah? So the immediate experience was like this overwhelming experience. And then you say, oh, the discriminating mind comes along and says, oh, it's just the heater. And then the sound just shrinks away almost to nothing. But when the mind's purified and alert and it has no obstructions, that sounds like a train coming through. This has happened to me. After Sesshin once, I went out of my house and I thought, what is that sound? It sounds like heaven. It's the most beautiful sound I ever heard. And I couldn't figure out what it was, and I walked over and it was just a sprinkler going through the grass going shh, 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 shh. But in a purified mind, so beautiful. So anyway, you know, one of the interesting things about Zen is that we spend a lot of time on the cushion. And we go down, down, down into what you might call the unconscious mind. When you're deep in the unconscious mind, there are no thoughts. There are no ghosts. You might encounter some on the way down, by the way. Thoughts, ghosts, monsters, we all have them, right? But at the deepest level of the mind, there's no thoughts. And the mind is surprising at that level because, you know, if you go to the bottom of the mind, so to speak, what you encounter is quite surprising. It's not at all what Dr. Freud might have predicted. Because it's not aggression. It's not murderous impulses, etc. It's like pure loving kindness, pure compassion. At its core, what we call the unconscious is pure loving kindness. So what I think is that people in the modern world are very out of balance. We've gotten a little confused, and we have mistaken the dream for the reality, and the reality for the dream. I think we can never know reality using the conscious mind, only little tiny pieces of it. What we know is real. I mean, science is real. It's just very limited, in my opinion. And I'm not a scientist, so I could be totally wrong. But very real, but very small, little pieces of reality. And my feeling is that we modern people live way too much in the conscious mind. And the conscious mind is very dreamlike. And that we need very much to get back in touch with our unconscious mind, which is not the realm of dreams and so on. That's a very shallow top layer of the mind, of the unconscious mind. A deeper mind has no form, no future and no past, a pure present moment without thought and without form. And I think we desperately need to balance these two minds, right? And we've gotten very confused about this. So, you know, you may come to practice and sit on the cushion and get up and not know why you feel better. And that's because you're activating a part of your mind which doesn't know in that way. You know, if that makes any sense, you know. We Zen people don't rely on knowing. There's something deeper than knowing. There's something deeper than thinking. There's a deeper mind, bigger self. My personal feeling is that this is a beautiful life, you know, just to encounter this bigger mind. And all of you came here to do that today, and I hope you leave here with a beautiful life energy pulsing through your bodies. You know, when you, my feeling is that, you know, thinking can be very exciting. I've been working on this book, and I get very excited when I work on something. You know, I read and I get excited by ideas, and I think that's wonderful. There's nothing, if you're a scientist and you're doing research and you feel that energy, you know, you go with it, that's wonderful. There's nothing wrong with that. But as I say, that consciousness could be a little crazy, you know, could be a little crazy after all. And I think it's necessary to have this balance, to anchor our lives in the deeper mind. You know, when you sit on the cushion and you watch the breath and your mind focus on the breath and your mind begins to become blank and dark, at first it feels like nothing, you know, there's nothing going on here. Conceptually, there never will be anything going on there. There never will be anything. But if you stay there, you know, just this beautiful energy, like a deathless energy. Beautiful. This is the heart of Zen, you know. And I think, you know, that if you just go down into that mind, you will agree with me, you know, that at the heart of that mind is just like this extraordinary compassion. You know, that's so wonderful. You know, to know that at the heart of our being, we are not hatred. You know, we're not murder. We're not Dr. Rasher. You know, we had to get very confused to create the Dr. Rasher. You know, inside of us is like a Buddha. Is Buddha. And so please find Buddha in yourself. In a dream, Kyozan Osho went to Maitreya's palace and was led to sit in the third seat. A senior monk struck with a gavel and said, "Today the one in the third seat will speak." Kyozan rose and, striking with the gavel, said, "The truth of the Mahayana is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations. Hear the truth. Hear the truth." Mumon's comment, "Now tell me, Did Hyozan preach or did he not? If he opens his mouth, he is lost. If he seals his mouth, he's lost. This is asking you to figure it out with your conscious mind. See, it's a contradiction, right? Simple contradiction. If you say yes, you're wrong. If you say no, you're wrong. So conscious mind can't experience a bigger reality. Okay. Even if he neither opens nor shuts his mouth, he is 108,000 miles away from the truth. Mumon's verse. In broad daylight, under the blue sky, he forges a dream in a dream. See, isn't that what we do so often? We think we're encountering reality. We're forging a dream in a dream. He makes up a monstrous story and tries to deceive the whole crowd. So Hyozan is actually, he's saying, helping people to wake up by calling attention to, using, you could say, using dreams to liberate people from their dreams.